Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
What happens when SMBs are priced out of ransomware protection? Haider Rabbani, the CEO of CyberSight, is here to tell us about that and much more about a subject we keep coming back to because it's so important to small business. Haider, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Haider, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your company, and where people could reach you before we do anything else.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I'm very happy to be here today, so thank you for inviting me. My background is I've been a PC hardware and software guy from the very time I graduated school, which was the University of Toronto, and I joined a company that many of you might recognize called Ashton Tate in the old DBase days. So I spent my early days in the software business with Ashton Tate, then Novell, and Intel, and I've had an opportunity to do a number of things at Intel. And since then, I've been working in a number of very interesting companies doing digital media, online marketing, and most recently, I've got the pleasure of running CyberSight, a San Diego-based cybersecurity intelligence platform company.
Well, that's a good starting. What's your website?
Yeah, so our website is www.cybersight, CYBERSIGHT.com.
So you hit us with a very provocative topic. What happens when SMBs are priced out of ransomware protection? What do you mean by that, and what do you mean by ransomware and this whole area?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think in general what we've experienced is that many businesses, whether they're small, medium, or large, often either don't understand or are completely unaware of the risk of cybersecurity attacks, particularly in the form of ransomware attacks. Ransomware is, I guess, a simple way of saying somebody who has malicious intent launches a software attack on you, either through downloads or bad links, that then starts to lock your files through an encryption method. And unless you pay them some sort of a ransom, as the name implies, they will essentially destroy your files. And people think that I have a backup or I might be backing up onto a cloud storage system and I'm safe. But in many cases, these ransomware attacks are very sophisticated and they can actually get your backups as well, your online backups, the cloud backups. And most businesses don't realize the ransom piece is actually the smallest piece of the financial impact, whether that's, you know, a few $100 or a few $1,000. The bigger cost tends to be the business interruption. So if you can imagine a small business which might be in the construction space or manufacturing or online sales, if your folks are completely idle, you're paying for salaries and wages and operations and yet have no ability to sell anything or do your billings or collect your money. And what we've found through research, and it's an IBM stat actually, is that more than 60% of small businesses that are affected by cyber attacks, it ends up costing them close to $700,000 within 6 months of an attack. And that can often be a very, very debilitating financial strain on companies that many don't recover from.
That in a nutshell is very good. But how do you say they're priced out of the market? Is there protection that's offered, or what do you mean by that?
Right. Yeah. So I think part of the challenge for all businesses is that how do you protect yourself? There's a lot of IT software that needs to be, you know, purchased, obviously, everything from productivity software to, you know, networking software and so forth. But in the case of security, a lot of businesses often overlook cybersecurity software, and they go for antivirus software, and they believe that antivirus software will do the job of anti-ransomware, which is not exactly accurate. Not all antivirus software provides that anti-ransomware protection. That's part one. Part two is those solutions that are very specific for what we call endpoint protection, as in PC protection and device protection, tends to be very expensive. And in some cases, you can imagine that if you are running, you know, a dozen computers or so, you may be spending several thousands of dollars per year to just simply have protective software on your computers. And many businesses just forego that, and they say, well, it's too expensive. We'll take our risks, and we have a hope and a prayer that hopefully we don't get attacked. So that's what we mean by that. And if you recall just a moment ago, I mentioned the financial impact, and then that's the secondary blow is the financial impact from an attack that might occur.
Hi, this is Dan Perkins. I'm the co-host on the show, and it's my turn to ask you some questions. So I want to get a better understanding. So let's go back to basics and help educate me.
Yep.
How long has your company CyberSight been in business?
So we've actually been in business about 3 years, 3.5 years. We were formerly called Zito Vault. It was another name. So we rebranded ourselves just recently to CyberSight. We believe that's much more indicative of what we do. And we
mm-hmm.
started off really focusing on the Internet of Things, the IoT space, and finding ways to protect the IoT devices on the network. And we very quickly realized that there's actually a greater need in the PC space on individual PCs and servers. So we pivoted our company and went full speed ahead with our anti-ransomware software, which we call Ransom Stopper, for consumers as well as for businesses. And we have made available the software free for home and personal use. And we have very, very, very affordable pricing models for small businesses so that nobody has to be priced out of the market. Everyone can be protected at a very, very reasonable rate.
It's a great idea. Let me talk about how your business has been growing. What's been happening since your business, you rebranded your business, you went into the PC market. What's been happening to
right.
your sales?
So we have had an overwhelming response, not only from consumers, but also from businesses. Today, I'm happy to report, I can't obviously share specific numbers with you. However, we now have customers globally who have downloaded, installed, and been using our software. We just launched the new version of the software in the last 60 days, and we have people all around the globe using the product, reporting back to us. They're very, very happy with the product and the protection that they're getting. On a business side, we have had a tremendous level of enthusiasm and response, particularly from medium and large businesses. In many cases, there are customers that we're working with in healthcare, financial services, education, and manufacturing that have said to us, we've got very sophisticated network security software, but we don't have endpoint protection, or the endpoint protection that we want is going to cost us several millions of dollars per year, and we simply don't have the budget left over to be able to do that. And what they really want is to be able to prevent, these nefarious attacks on their networks and on their end users, and they want a very specific, lightweight product that provides that protection at an affordable price. What we're hearing from customers, again, in that category of medium and large in particular, is that while there's some fantastic product out there from other companies, they're often far more than they need, and they're just looking for a very specialized set of functions to prevent these bad cyber attacks.
So our program is pointed towards small business people.
Right.
And it sounded like in your discussion, a little bit of your discussion with Don, is that there's been, my words, not yours, has been some resistance on the part of small business historically on ransomware because the costs have been perhaps prohibitive. But at least as I think I'm hearing you say, that you have been able to offer a great level of protection for a reasonable price. Is that true?
Correct. And I don't want to just characterize it as purely a financial function. Often it's misunderstanding. It's often there's a perception that on the part of small businesses that I already have my favorite antivirus product, which should be good enough and protect me well enough. And that's also a fallacy. Many antivirus products simply don't have the ability to catch brand new ransomware strains. So the lack of protection is often a combination of things. Sometimes it's financial, sometimes it's awareness. And so what we do is we focus on ransomware that does not require any kind of signatures or patterns or databases, and we have our proprietary technology that is constantly scanning files and processes. So as soon as you start a new process or you download a new file, we immediately scan that and make sure that it's safe to proceed. And if it is perceived to be a risk, we actually will stop that process. We suspend it. We put it into a quarantine or a holding tank, if you will, and the user can then say, yes, this is actually a known good process, or no, it's a bad process, and please continue to block it.
So what kind of updates do you have to go through in this ever-changing cyber attack world?
Well, that's the beautiful part about what we do. First of all, there are no updates on our side. The user never has to initiate any kind of an update on the detection side. Now, there are, of course, software updates on our operational side, but as far as finding and detecting bad software, you don't need to do any updates. We do, of course, have user-prompted software updates for the overall application, but a user doesn't need to necessarily do that. So that's number one. Number two is that we operate seamlessly, and we focus on pre-attack prevention as opposed to post-attack recovery. And that's probably the single biggest thing that we are differentiated by with respect to our competitors. Many of our competitors say, okay, we can detect an attack as it's happening, but you'll always have some degree of file loss. What we do is we create intentional honeypots and decoys and target files that should never be touched. And if those files are touched, then we know that something bad is happening, and we're happy to sacrifice those decoy files. So real data doesn't get damaged, and in our opinion, even a few files is too many to lose. So that's really our mode of operation.
Do you do all of your work online as opposed to a sales force?
Well, not absolutely. So we have a combination. We do a tremendous amount of our work online directly from our website. We also work with channel partners and resellers. So, for example, we have a number of reseller partners who service small and medium businesses, and they are actually taking our product and bringing it to a number of small and medium businesses and deploying it for their clients. And then we also have strategic partnerships with a number of different reseller organizations who represent us in the field. So there are different security service providers who are doing things like centralized management and remediation, and their sales teams are also carrying our product and bringing it into the marketplace.
But if I heard you correctly, internet is a big part of your business.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that way we can reach as many people as possible.
And how do you drive people to that, to the internet, to your site?
Besides, so there's a number of different ways. Well, your program's a great start, obviously. So awareness is certainly one of the key things. So we're doing a number of things. We're actually working with a number of clients on things like security training for those clients who are asking for it. What are good security practices? So we're helping them build their security posture, and we work with their resellers in many cases. The other thing that we do is we're focusing on key vertical segments. As an example, I mentioned earlier, one of our let me give you a handful of vertical segments that we're targeting, the legal industry. And when we say legal, it's not just the attorneys practicing in big firms, but we're actually targeting small, you know, one and two and three attorney firms that are maybe, you know, small practices. Not only the attorneys, but the folks who are doing billing, the folks who might be doing evidence retention and or digitization, the folks who are doing things like court reporting and transcripts, depositions, all components of the legal ecosystem are things that we're targeting. And we're attending a number of trade shows, forums, keynotes, that sort of thing. And we're looking at a number of these types of vertical segments. So legal is one area. We're focusing also on healthcare. We're focusing on financial services, manufacturing. So we're looking at each of these categories, and we're doing things like news stories. We're speaking to journalists in those categories that are relevant and have audiences that are aligned with those key business areas. And we're happy to provide our feedback and guidance. And the other thing that we're doing for larger customers is we're doing pilots and testing. And here in the next couple of weeks, we'll be able to start providing small businesses and small and medium businesses also with an ability to try our business version of the software in their own environment at their own pace. And see how the software works free of charge for, you know, a few weeks and see if it works for them.
Do you think that there are a lot of people, small business, you talked about the one or two or three member law firms and other small, very small businesses, which make up the vast majority of businesses in the United States, by the way.
Yes.
But do you think that a lot of them are falsely believing, well, then who's going to screw around with me with three computers?
Exactly.
I really don't have any exposure.
Correct. Yes, that's actually one of the big things that we're seeing. So, how I would answer that is this: often it's not some shadowy character, you know, who's a big sophisticated black hat hacker who's going after a three man operation. Many times it's a teenager sitting on the other side of the world who's looking for beer money for the weekend, and it's easy because they can subcontract contracted malware writers or ransomware writers to basically cook up a little ransomware, put it out there, and get their beer money before the weekend, and it's just random. So that's certainly one thing that we're seeing a lot of. So it's basically, we call that ransomware as a service. So you don't have to have any experience or knowledge at all. You can actually get someone else to do all the dirty work for you. They take a small percentage of the ransom, and you get the bulk of it. So that's one thing, and that's a kind of a random phishing expedition. The other thing that we're noticing, and I don't want to sound too cloak and dagger here, but often there are competitive pressures. You know, if you think about it, if you happen to be a roofing company in the middle of the winter rainy season, and your competitor is running away with all the business, well, you know, somebody might target that company, right? There are business, competitive reasons that people do this kind of thing. And we've seen this, by the way. So this is not something I'm speculating on. We have seen small businesses in construction and manufacturing and online that have actually been impacted by competitors or people who feel wronged or grieved in some way. And so it's not always, necessarily a cyber attack that is orchestrated by, people on the other side of the world who are cyber criminals. Sometimes it's just, you know, business competition and or personal hurt feelings.
Hmm. I know that we have seen, we've had people on the show who in larger firms have indicated that that most of the cyber attacks that they have seen and worked on primarily come from a disgruntled employee or somebody who the corporation didn't change the passwords, the codes, or whatever, and not somebody from a calling from his mother's basement in Siberia somewhere. But I'm sure that those people, I'm sure that those people are there. So yes.
Could I jump in here? Because he just said something that I don't think I've heard anyplace else. And are you really saying, Heidern, that there are people out there, small businesses, that have actually used this tactic to hurt competitors in relatively small areas?
I'm not a firsthand witness to this, so I have to be careful. But we have heard from small businesses that they have been the victims of cyber attacks. And when the investigations were conducted by whoever the authorities were or their security researchers were, these small businesses were sometimes, and I don't want to say, again, I don't want to create unnecessary alarm, but sometimes, yes, it's often been discovered that there were competitive forces or, aggrieved, individuals. It could be former employees. It could be anything along that lines. But yes, we have actually experienced that where, small companies in the construction space that I'm aware of, that we directly know, we've seen that kind of thing where these cyber attacks have occurred.
No, it's ironic that you said that because over the Christmas holidays at a party, I was talking to a roofer who thought that was what happened to him. And I listened to the story and didn't know anything, but there may be truth to that. But can I go in a different direction? You said something else, that you're trying to find small businesses that can test out your product, et cetera. Well, we have a platform, as Dan has said, that reaches a large segment of the small business population. And we were wondering if there's some way we might help you reach that audience. Is that something of interest to you?
Absolutely, and we invite all of your listeners and your partners to participate on our website at cybersight.com. And again, cybersight is cybersight.com. You can actually go on there and request a trial of the business edition of the software that comes to us, and we will set up your listeners. And what we provide is basically a 15-day trial that they can deploy on their computers, the software, try out the management console. And I just want to point out the main difference between our free home version and the business version is that with the business version, we have a centralized management console. So either the in-house IT administrator, or if you have somebody who does your IT work on an outsource basis, that person or persons can actually oversee what's going on in your network and in your computing environment, and they can actually whitelist and blacklist files and processes, and they would get all the alerts. In the individual personal version, there is no central management console, so we intentionally designed it that way so that for home use you don't need that. But absolutely, everyone's invited to go to our website. Send in your request, and we'll be happy to help you out.
Thank you, Dan. Back to you.
The one thing we haven't talked about is the magnitude of the problem.
Right.
And we keep hearing about all of these hacks of, credit card files, and millions and hundreds of millions of files and all that stuff. But how big is the problem?
Yeah, the problem, unfortunately, the problem is really big, and getting bigger. If so, rather than speak in abstract, I can point to some recent attacks that occurred last summer, for example. Many people may be familiar with an attack called the WannaCry ransomware attack that happened, I believe it was in the May-June timeframe. And this started over in Europe and very quickly spread across Europe and then over the Atlantic and back into the U.S. In a matter of like 24 to 48 hours, something in the order of, you know, 250,000 or more servers and PCs were affected in just literally a day or so. And that was just one ransomware strain. And what we're finding is that these ransomware strains can be modified. You can create a variation of them, and that basically becomes a new ransomware, you know, product, and it can be relaunched again and again and again. The level of sophistication is very, very low for people to be able to do this. So we're seeing attacks continuing to increase because of the low barrier to entry and the relatively high returns. We also have noticed that with the advancement of cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin and Ethereum and others, the ransom attackers can actually collect their ransom almost anonymously. So there's virtually no way for them to be traced and found. So they could be sitting next door or across the globe on the other side. And it's very, very difficult to find who those individuals are. So there's a degree of obscurity where they're hidden from view. And it's not like, you know, somebody who goes in and robs a gas station or robs a bank. There's a physical action there, and you have physical descriptions. In this context, it's an unknown, unseen, unheard, perpetrator. And they can inflict a lot of damage. And when you think about it, they don't need a lot of people. If they launch 1,000 attacks and they only get one or two people who fall prey to it, that's pretty good numbers for them. You know, if you're sitting in a bedroom somewhere and not worrying about a cost of doing it or a risk of getting caught, you know, it becomes very, very easy for them to get away with it. The other thing I just do want to point out is sometimes it's not just a lack of anti-ransomware software. Sometimes it's other data practices and security practices. As an example, updating your systems, updating your operating system, making sure that the latest version of your software is downloaded and installed. Those are really, really good, important things that I would encourage all your listeners to do. Is keep your systems up to date. It's an easy process, a relatively easy process, whether you do it yourself or you have your IT administrators do it. It's something that should be done. And that's often the weak point where the cyber attackers look for systems that are running outdated software because those have known vulnerability. And that's where they come in.
So let me ask you one last question. Is the technology, the defensive technology, still lagging behind, or is it gaining any ground on the ransomware technology?
Well, since we're in the business of anti-ransomware, we believe that we're making very, very good headway, very strong progress here. And like any technology, like any kind of security, challenge, it's always a cat and mouse game, unfortunately, right? We get more sophisticated and the bad guys get more sophisticated as well. So I think it's a continuing evolving process, and it's a continuous effort. So I think we've made good advances. Like I said, we've shifted from post-attack recovery to one where we really prevent the attacks and avoid the problem in the first place. Now, nothing is 100%. The only thing 100% is turning off your computer and unplugging it. That's 100%, but that's not very effective if you want to do business and communicate with the rest of the world, right? So, unfortunately, it's we make progress, and so do they.
Yeah. Well, Hyder, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to toss it back to Don.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Hyder Rabbani, the CEO of CyberSight. A link to his website will be on Recalculating Biz Tonight. You can hear this show and every other show on recalculating.biz anytime. Thank you, Hyder, so much for a very interesting time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
You know, Dan, before we go any further, I want our audience to know about your new runaway hit book on Alzheimer's disease and how it affects teenagers. Please tell us about it.
Yeah, Don, thank you. The book is called Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? It's a book written primarily for children ages 9 to 12, but really needs to be read by the entire family. And what I try to do is I try to take the subject matter of dementia and the challenges to a different level in the form of a mystery story with my two little detectives, two little girls, Hudson and Charlotte. And it really creates a breakthrough opportunity for small children and parents and families to begin to understand the problem with dementia. See, Don, the real challenge is that the children are the forgotten people. Mom and dad spend so much time working to try and take care of mom and dad, they don't take the time to explain to the children what's going on in grandma or grandpa's brain. So you can buy it at Amazon.com, or you can order it through your local bookstore, or any online bookstore besides Amazon has it available. Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? Illustrations are spectacular. A story by Dan Perkins.
Your runaway bestseller, new book.
Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? By Dan Perkins.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
Dan Baird, founder and CEO of, and I love the title of his company, Crack the Crowd, a leading marketing and digital innovation firm whose strategies have helped startups and enterprises raise tons of capital for their new products and services. He's here to talk about 2018 predictions and pitfalls in digital marketing you must know for raising capital. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dan, tell us a little bit about yourself, your website, and a little bit about your company before we get into anything else.
Sure. So I'm kind of a blood-driven entrepreneur, third-generation entrepreneur, even in my corporate life working for large-scale companies, have basically been in the departments where we were launching new companies. And after doing that for about 15 years and seeing crowdfunding, I launched a small marketing and strategy firm, we help people kind of bring their products and their ideas to life and help them seek and collect financing for them via crowdfunding as a vehicle. So we've helped philanthropic entities like Child Rescue Association conduct missions for human trafficking victims in South America. We've helped startups raise capital via, you know, traditional kind of like Kickstarter-style crowdfunding as well as equity crowdfunding. Companies raise millions of dollars there, some of which are, you know, now using it as a strategy. We've got some large firms that are now using these kind of techniques to seek institutional capital. Our latest client is KBSDirect.com, which is doing a $1 billion raise on one of their own sites. We help these companies kind of put together the package, how to talk about it, how to do it and do it in a regulated manner, a safe manner, and how to launch that product and meet their investors.
Wow, that was a lot. But I'm going to ask you a specific question. How do you help people raise capital?
Sure. In many ways, it's the same process that you use for launching a company. We basically help walk them through a process where they gather kind of and understand the feedback about their product, what really makes it tick and what makes people respond to it. We combine that with getting introductions into kind of industry experts, journalists, bloggers, celebrities, et cetera, that can help kind of promote the message. And then we help them target via several channels, you know, PPC, via social media, and even using kind of inbound content techniques that kind of attract people that are looking to invest in companies like theirs.
Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you. I've got a lot of questions, but I'm sure you do as well.
I'll do my best. Thank you. Welcome, Dan.
Hey, thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Good to meet you.
Yes, sir. I'm a registered investment advisor. I've been in the business of managing money for almost 45 years. Never done a crowdfunding mm-hmm. deal. Looked at it a number of times, but for some reason never ever pulled the trigger. In today's marketplace, when you're doing a crowdfunding deal, what are returns that crowdfund investors are potentially looking for?
There's a lot to unpack in that. There's a little bit of a difference between kind of the traditional registered investment advisor and oftentimes like you're managing high net worth individuals' money, right?
Yes, sir.
You're seeking for long-term diversified investment strategies and things like that. Now, there's absolutely
right.
a place for that, and you're correct that the institutional capital players, I would put you into that bucket, are moving into the space now. They're now noticing that like we're kind of hitting critical mass, and the access to kind of really broad deal flow is now there. So they're not necessarily just limited to the deals that are on a specific marketplace or platform. And they're going, hey, there's actually some pretty good investment returns. Sometimes people seeking real estate and they're, as far as predicting returns, that's something hard for me to do, but it's not uncommon to see projections between 5 and 12. A lot of those platforms have pretty decent return strategies and pretty decent return historical records. They'll post those to show you, here's how much money we've made, lost, returned to investors, et cetera. They're pretty public about that stuff because you're rightfully careful, right? A lot of the hubbub around blockchain and ICOs, and there's news and press about failed campaigns too. It's all transparent and it's all out there. So it's one of those where the retail investor in the crowdfunding space, kind of the fully independent investor, is oftentimes looking for something a little bit that includes a return but also includes an emotional appeal. Sometimes they're looking for a product or a space that they just really, really like. They do understand the financials, but in many cases, they kind of want to be a part of the story. So there's a little bit more to offer there. And in many ways, because crowdfunding is so broad, there's more deals to pick from, and there's a better likelihood that they can find some investment that really kind of speaks to them too.
Yeah. You mentioned that your firm does nonprofits. I would assume that the reason why an individual would give a nonprofit money is because they believe in the mission or the objectives of the particular nonprofit. So how is that how is that different than a charitable gift?
Oftentimes they fall into the same boat. They're 501c3s and they're fully taxed. They're treated as gifts. But it's the same kind of concept. As I mentioned, they're looking for kind of an emotional appeal. And again, this is a space you're using the web where finding one deal, one charitable contribution or whatever versus another, the switching cost between the two is zero. And in many cases, the technique is a little bit more like, so if you imagine you're going to kind of contribute to, say, the Red Cross, you're kind of just contributing to a general concept of the Red Cross, right? They help people in general. You're using kind of a crowdfunding or crowdsourcing technology, it's a little bit different in that you're usually doing it for a very specific use. We have a specific well in Latin America that we would like to dig for a very specific village. Help us raise the funds for that specific project. So it's a little bit more specific, and it's a little bit more But in both cases, they'd be charitable contributions, tax exempt.
Okay. So that what you're which I thought was fascinating was that you said that people might give a charitable gift to the broad Red Cross, while other people might give specific money for a specific project within the Red Cross, whether it's a well or water or electricity or whatever, so that people who are interested in a particular finite opportunity would look at crowdfunding as opposed to saying, okay, I'm going to give $50,000 to the Red Cross, let them do with it what they want, as opposed to $50,000. And this is where you differentiate. You're the one that goes out and finds organizations, nonprofits that have a specific, very specific mission that might be attractive to a certain segment of the population. Is that a fair assessment?
It is, but actually most of the people that are utilizing this, like the big trend that you're seeing for 2018 is actually a shift towards institutional capital like you. Like, you know, you hear about the crowdfunding as far as charitable fundraising a lot. There's still a lot of innovation going in that space, but as far as our demand and our focus for 2018, we actually are hearing much more from the institutional capital side of the equation, commercial real estate investments. And multifamily investors, things in that space is actually where we're seeing most of the action, at least for our space specifically, our kind of client base specifically.
Okay. In that case of the real estate, you're providing the platform that people can aggregate or pool their money, and then you have somebody who has a deal to put together to buy, and you simply are providing a funding source for that organization.
We help them navigate kind of the regulatory hurdles. They have the deal. We usually connect them with the platform, and we bring it to life. Yeah. So they already have the widget. We show them how to actually show it to the general public. And as you know, there's a ton of different regulations and things of what you can and cannot say to do this work, right? Forward-looking statements and other things of that nature that you really have to be careful on. We help navigate and make sure that those types of things are taken care of carefully. There's teams that are trained on what you can and cannot say and who we can and cannot reach out to and how we reach out to them in a regulated and kind of an appropriate manner. So, we want to make sure that the investors get paid. So,
right. We've done a number of programs over the last year with this, what I call this evolving market, which is called fintech, and in essence, non-bank banks, driven by the Great Recession of 2008, when the major banks pulled out of the small business market and were not interested in providing funding for small business, the fintech operations evolved as a funding source for operating capital and other things. It seems to me that, and this may be the wrong analogy, and you can certainly correct me, is that the explosion of crowdfunding is in response to lots of things, but one of them is that the banking sector became so risk-averse, they didn't realize that there were people still out there, even in bad economic times, who had money to put to work and were willing to invest if they could get a reasonable return. Is that a good analogy or is that a bad analogy?
Correct. That's a very big part of it. I mean, you know, I've seen some of the work you guys have done talking about small business loans and stuff, and it's one of those where regardless of what the return or the approval rates are, the fact is that, you know, I'm recalling this, so I'll have to actually look it up, but I believe that seeking bank financing for small businesses is now the sixth in their decision-making hierarchy in terms of how they're actually planning to secure it. And it's just one of those where, regardless of the approval rates, the reputation is there that it's very hard to secure bank financing. And crowdfunding, right, as you can tell, kind of spreads the gamut. There's charitable stuff on one end of the spectrum. And then there's the kind of Kickstarter campaigns that you hear about, which are basically, you know, it's on your balance sheet. It's treated like revenue. You know, it's pre-sales essentially. Then there's equity crowdfunding where you're actually taking small businesses and you're giving them, you know, maybe a few $1,000 from the retail population. Then there's the institutional stuff. In that space, they're finding out as this tool evolves that the crowdfunding has a little bit more of a unique impact in that you can build it into a marketing strategy to grow your company, because a lot of the marketing techniques that we use are the same techniques that you use to grow your business anyways. And in some cases, if you secure a raving fan or an equivalent, you've got someone that's going to buy any product that you put out there. They're oftentimes a really good investor. They already understand your product. They know your team, and they're kind of giving you kind of like that 10-year commitment that we think you're doing the right thing, and we think it so much that we think you're going to be around in 10 years, and we want to be a part of that story. And so for that reason, crowdfunding is becoming a little bit more interesting in that you can kind of rely a little bit more on kind of the Warren Buffett method of, you know, invest in the products that you really know, understand, and purchase yourself. You already know the space. It's not necessarily all the financial gymnastics that people can do, but there's a lot of data out there that actually says the crowd in its collective is actually pretty intelligent, right? The rates of fraud that people expect to see in crowdfunding versus those that are actually proven by data is actually really, really small, because it only takes one smart expert to raise their hand and say, hey, by the way, everybody, this is a fraud, to kind of ruin it for the scammer. You still see entrepreneurs getting in over their heads and things like that. You should absolutely be kind of concerned and do your due diligence on any deal, charitable organization, Kickstarter fund, whatever that you contribute to. But thus far, the dynamics of crowdfunding, both in equity and kind of the rewards and gift scenarios, is actually looking like it's becoming a little bit closer to the new normal in how people finance their companies.
So, Dan, let's just pause for a second and tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you to see if they can qualify for working with you. How do they reach you?
Sure. There's our website. It's at crackthecrowd.com. And if you like, you can go and follow me. I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. I'm Mr. Dan Baird on Instagram, and I'm Whistlin on Twitter, WHISTLN on Twitter. But go ahead and follow us there. And on the site, there's forms where they can kind of submit, and we can set up time to talk.
So, and how do you get paid?
We take standard agency fees. There's rules in our space, usually, because we're, again, like at least for 2018, we're focused very much on the equity space, and there's rules on how we get paid, and it's usually as a flat fee. It's illegal for us to take a part of the raise as a kind of a percentage fee to kind of protect the investor, which we're totally fine with. So we usually take just standard kind of retainers. As we spend the retainer, we kind of convert that money to revenue, and we go on and forward. It's pretty common for a lot of our clients to stay on as beyond their raises as just kind of ongoing standard clients with a standard marketing arrangement.
Is crowdfunding a replacement for angel investors?
It's an addition to. A lot of the people
addition
that we're seeking out, because a lot of the people that we're seeking out, like you'll see a small percentage of high net worth individuals, maybe like 7%+, that actually really want to independently manage their own portfolios. Those are perfect angels, right? They're oftentimes looking in. They're usually the pretty good description for that investor I was mentioning earlier where, they know a little bit about the finance. They're not uninformed by any means, but they're oftentimes investing in a space that they really feel for in one way, shape, or form or another. They have a thing for AI, and they really want to see some AI come to life, and they want to be there, and they want to be a part of that journey. So, it's absolutely – I mean, if you're an angel, it basically means instead of being kind of locked to the local angel group where you sit down and you have the kind of pitch – company come to you and sit in the room with 50 other angels. Now the world is your oyster. You go online, you can go to several different websites. You can go to Seed Invest, Next Seed, Equity.net. I mean, there's a dozen of them. You can sit down and you can look through deals and see if you actually want to invest in these companies directly.
I want to give Dan Baird a very real world scenario and ask what he thinks. I sit on the board of the National Robotics Education Foundation. And we're dedicated to the inclusion of robotics education within the curriculums of elementary and high school and college courses. And we have been looking about how to raise funding for a national convention of educators on robotics education. Is that something that I'll put it that is, what are some of the ways you would suggest we could raise the funding for such an event?
Sure. So I mentioned earlier that on one end of the spectrum, there's crowdfunding that's a little bit more like a gift or pre-sales. Oftentimes, those platforms that you hear about, oftentimes on the news like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, those are largely presented for specifically a purpose of, hey, we have a specific campaign or a specific project. that we're going to put to the marketplace, and we'd like to see if they're interested. Now, for small businesses or organizations like yours, it's really interesting because it allows you to kind of build the idea and really focus on, do we have, is there a there? You know, we'd like to do this convention. Here's who would participate. Here's where it would be. Here's how we plan to pull it off. Those platforms are designed as pre-sales. The person contributing gets no equity in the company whatsoever. They are not guaranteed any return of any kind. That doesn't mean you're off the hook by any means. But it does mean that you can kind of flip the logistics chain and actually figure out if people are willing to contribute and pay for your idea prior to you actually having to pull off that convention. And potentially, you know, in many cases, you know, entrepreneurs will have to seek financing before they really know if anyone wants to buy the product or not. So those platforms allow you to put the idea out there, put a video around it and a couple other things, and see if people buy into it and will contribute anyways. And oftentimes, if someone's in a pre-revenue stage with their company or product or idea, that's where I would suggest they go, because they can basically test the market in a really, really efficient way. Once they're post-revenue, and I usually, you know, there are companies that are still pre-revenue that go for equity crowdfunding. I usually think that's kind of a bad idea. I try to push people off and say, no, go and develop a customer base first. You want some people that can vouch for you, because oftentimes crowdfunding is kind of converting social capital and word of mouth to monetary, legitimate, you know, literal capital. Once you're post-revenue, or if those companies graduate from kind of an incubator or something from your robotics association, I then put them into kind of an angel investment scenario, where you're seeking more kind of like seed round funding, you know, and you're looking for something in the 6 or 7 figures. And then you can take it from there. I mean, the beauty of this is that there is a crowdfunding type for your company as it grows. If you're pre-revenue, you can go to the Kickstarter stuff. If you're post-revenue, you can go to the equity crowdfunding platforms and you can actually talk to real investors. And if you want, there's, you know, the places where we play often where there's institutional capital and there's people raising billions of dollars. So there's options there.
Wow. But let me ask you one more question. When they first started out, all of these fundraising programs required that you supply the list of initial contacts. Is that still the case, or have they built up a sufficient number of people that go there on a regular basis that supplying such a list has become less important?
You still need a list whether or not they'll tell you that you do. The reason is oftentimes this, if you have an interesting idea, like companies like mine can amplify the effect, right? I can't guarantee you virality, but I can guarantee you that we can put the tools in your messages that would enable them to become viral, right? Anyone who promises virality probably just stole your wallet. The initial list is really important because it gives companies like me and companies like yours a place to start for validation. Remember that process I mentioned where we said, go and gather feedback from that small core kind of raving fans. Make sure that you can generate some word of mouth and you can get some legitimacy to the celebrities, the bloggers, and the journalists that are going to kind of validate your product for the larger group. That's why that initial list is so important. The larger it is, the better. Usually when companies come to us and they say, we don't have any lists, I'd say, you know, most of the time we would actually suggest going with another vendor because we're usually not comfortable working with someone that doesn't have anything to speak of, because you know, there's your marketing list, but just so you know, there's a lot of companies that are, if they're in the pre-revenue stages, their list comes in the forms of family and friends and contacts and, you know, former business relationships that they can rely on kind of, you know, my personal integrity, you know that I'm going to actually pull this off or not, in lieu of having an organically built marketing list from a kind of a traditional source. So you have a list either way. And if you think about it, everyone that joins your robotic lab has a list too, right? You can aggregate every founder, every student, every one of them has family and friends that say, hey, would you like to kind of participate in some way, shape, or form? So they've all got one, but it's really important you provide it. Most of the time, the platform will do next to, I would tell most people it's safer to assume the platform will do nothing for you than to assume they'll do anything for you. Most of the time, it really is on you, and you can hire companies like mine to kind of amplify the effects. But it's incredibly difficult to introduce an unknown investor to a completely unvalidated concept and have it be successful. Someone has to vouch for you. And that goes for, you know, us even taking them as a client as well. So.
Dan, back to you.
Thank you. So, with the change in the economy, and most economists now expecting the economy to be fairly robust in 2018, what do you see demand for your product?
Oh, it's going up. Crowdfunding was basically, it went legal again, I guess you could say, like the ability to publicly talk about fundraising for equity purposes was basically made legal again with the Jobs Act in 2014. So it's still relatively new, but it's growing each and every year. We're, as I mentioned earlier, we're actually seeing more and more institutions start to take notice and actually realize, hey, there's more and more unique deal flow that's available here, and we want to participate. So the demand for our work is going up and always has. With the explosion of other things like blockchain, with, if you've heard of them, ICOs, initial kind of coin offerings, these are kind of sister ideas to crowdfunding, and especially equity crowdfunding, that, you know, I don't know if you just heard, but there was a bunch of news yesterday around Peter Thiel from Founders Fund and the fact that his company just made a large investment, and it's only going up. It's, as I mentioned earlier, it's becoming the new normal. There's going to be more and more focus on it.
So when you, my last question is, when you look at investors, you use the word consistently throughout the show, investors. What do you mean when you say investors?
In both the literal and the figurative sense, most of the time our clients are seeking equity. They're doing, you know, traditional equity or debt financing, but it's literally investors that are expecting a return on their investment. Most of the time, the people contributing to your campaign, whether it's in the reward space like Kickstarter or whatever else, they're expecting a return of some kind. So it's either going to be in the form of a product that's a little bit probably evolved past prototype stage and they're the first in line to get it, or it's literally return, but more and more investors are watching and taking action in this space. So in most cases, I mean literally investors.
So the institutions that are investing, are these pension funds or hedge funds or private equity or all of the above?
I think you're going to see in 2018 a little bit of all the above. They've been watching the space.
Okay.
We have directives that are working pretty heavily with RIAs and targeting RIAs specifically. There is a lot of action to kind of gather those eyeballs, and they're taking notice. It's one of these new kind of – they're basically finding that there used to be kind of the FICO score that your bank could use to give you a loan, and crowdfunding is becoming a new way to kind of, in a transparent manner, kind of validate and see that the market has validated a specific idea or a specific offering. Those institutions and those investors are taking notice and saying, hey, if the market is this interested, maybe there's something here that I didn't get.
We unfortunately run out of time. We've been talking with Dan Baird. He's founder and CEO of Crack the Crown. A link to his website will be on tonight on www.recalculating.biz, where you can also hear all our other broadcasts of Recalculating Radio. Dan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jim. You too. I appreciate the time.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.